Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, celebrating 20 years dedicated to advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, as Governor Jerry Brown is set to sign a 10-year extension of the state's cap-and-trade program later today, we'll learn about a companion bill he also plans to sign that aims to clean up more localized air pollution in places like the Valley. We'll find out why some say it doesn't go far enough, and talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Julie Cart of Cal Matters. We begin, though, with the latest on the Detweiler fire that's burning in the mountains of Mariposa County. A number of structures destroyed there. Containment on that blaze now up to 65% as some people are starting to go home. Over 78,000, nearly 79,000 acres burned so far in the Hunters Valley area, Mount Bullion, and other communities around Mariposa County. The city of Mariposa, though, was saved. And Jeffrey Hess has spent much of the last week reporting from communities in that area. He joins us right now on Valley Edition. Jeffrey, welcome.
Thank you very much.
This was a really interesting fire in that it behaved in a way that really caught some people off guard. It spread very quickly. And a week ago today, the community of Mariposa was evacuated. What was the general mood like in the mountain communities over the past week? Because you sort of saw this thing crescendo and now it's coming back down. And we'll hear from some clips from some of the people affected in just a bit. Well, what was your impression of what you saw?
My impression was just the speed at which this fire had evolved, I think, took a lot of people by surprise. Many people in this community that I talked to have lived there for decades and they're used to they're used to wildfires. But a lot of people I talk to say we've just never seen anything like this, where over the course of subsequent nights, the fire just doubled and then doubled again and then doubled again. And it went from a small fire to one that required the evacuation of entire communities and a town that required the evacuation of Mariposa. And for a minute there, it looked like Mariposa itself might be in danger. And so the people who have lived there all these years say, what just happened? You know, because it did go from a small fire to a very significant fire so quickly that people are just still trying to grapple with what had happened.
Now, I know some people have said, well, the drought is over now. We would expect a quieter fire year. I understand that Cal Fire officials say that's not the case.
Yeah, it's actually ironically the opposite of that. Because of all the rain in the lower foothills of the mountains, these are grass-covered hills largely. They're not the tall Sierra Forest areas. And as you drive through, you just see entire hillsides that would have been grass with sparse trees just absolutely blackened with soot and ash where the fire has come through all that grass that grew with all the rain. There was so much grass, and as happens every California summer, the grass died. That's a natural part of it. And the fire just ate that up. And that's how it exploded so quickly and covered so much ground so fast.
Now, you had thousands of firefighters, still have thousands of firefighters on the scene working to contain this blaze from all over the state. I know I was in Merced the other day. I saw Beverly Hills, all over Southern California, different fire engines. A great response there from the state. But for the residents, you said a lot of them have been through fires before. Was there a certain complacency that you heard from some of them thinking, oh, you know what, we've been through these before? Was that something you heard, or what was the mood?
I don't think complacency is the right word. I really do think it's shock, which is that, you know, we are prepared. Everyone who I talked to, who even people who lost their homes, were like, no, we were preparing to evacuate, but we just didn't expect it to happen so fast. I mean, I talked with one gentleman who we'll hear from in a little bit, and he thought, they heard, oh, the evacuation order is not going to come this way. And within hours, the sheriffs were coming around saying, no, you've got to get out now. And it was moving so fast, fire crews couldn't even keep up with it. And there's a lot of gratitude in Mariposa County. As you drive around, you see signs everywhere that say thank you for the firefighters, because once they started to get a hold of it, you can see where the fire would have gone right up to somebody's house, but a fire line would have stopped it from going that far. So a lot of people are very thankful But I mean, I can't speak for CAL FIRE, but the sense in the community is that this one was just unexpectedly fast and hot.
Yeah, and I know that CAL FIRE said a nearly unprecedented number of air tankers used on this fire, and certainly successful efforts to protect the city of Mariposa itself, which I don't believe suffered any significant damage, but many communities just outside of Mariposa, and especially to the north on Highway 49, the 140 area as well. I understand Mount Bullion was one of the areas especially hard hit. You were just there yesterday.
Yeah, it. I mean, the phrase "it looks like a war zone" gets overused, but it really does look like it. The area got bombed out. I want to start with 92-year-old Leota Brewer. She's lived here with her two daughters, for almost her entire life. Her home was saved, but just barely. Like, the fire went up to the wall of her house. It burned her flowers. It melted her outdoor thermometer and exploded the glass table. They lost all sorts of outbuildings and vehicles at a workshop that they had on their property. And she's just very still surprised and doesn't quite know how to put it into words.
Terrible. Just sick. Heartsick, you know, to see all your things go down the drain, you know, or... It's very hard.
I think your daughter said you're 92?
92.
How long have you lived in the area?
All my life, practically. In the Merced and this area.
Mm-hmm. You ever seen anything like this?
No, I never have. I guess I have been lucky, you know, to not have any fires. And it's actually just devastating to see, you know, the damage. But we'll make it.
So that's a woman who's got nearly a century of experience dealing with these fires and living in this area, and she's never seen anything like it.
And there's a photo that you have of her house, I believe it is. It's on our website that I think people should check out. That thermometer that you mentioned, it looks like some Salvador Dali clock, but this is hanging on her wall. It melted, but the house is saved. Overall, 63 single-family residences destroyed, 67 other outbuildings or other structures damaged. So a significant damage to the community there. Chris Allen is another person that you met. Tell us about Chris.
Yeah, he actually did lose his home. When I saw him, he was surveying the damage. He was standing in the middle of what used to be his living room. All that remained for his house was the chimney. And we talked about the speed of the fire. He talks about how quickly it came upon him.
We had them come in and tell us we had to evacuate because the fire was so close, and it just came through so fast. None of the firefighters could even get up here in time. So
that's what I keep hearing, like this fire just moved so fast it was on top of people before they even had a chance.
Yes. I mean, they barely got the houses down the road safe, but it came through so fast and hot, there was no stopping it.
So he's actually a neighbor of Leota's, and his house is gone, but her house is there. Her house is the only one on this remote road that I found that survived. It's really pretty amazing, because I went to the end of the street thinking, well, there's not going to be anything down here because everyone's home is just completely destroyed. And then somehow one house survived. Chris's yard had several old cars in it that they were planning to fix up, including a 54 Chevy that he said he and his dad were planning on fixing.
And it's hard to come back and after 22 years of living here and all the fires we've had, this is the worst one. All we do is start over.
Now, I understand Cathy's Valley, which is a community to the west of Mariposa on Highway 140, also was a big subject of the firefight. Tell us about what you saw there.
That's an area where once the firefighters were beginning to get a handle on the bigger part of the fire, they were able to protect many more homes. And as you drive up, you'll see if it's an open area, they basically let it burn and then try to defend the structures around it. Mitch Bowes lives on a 40-acre plot he has his own house. His son-in-law has a house there. So there's several houses on this ranch. And he says the firefighters protected his home. They kept the flames just feet from his house. And he's just amazed that they were able to save all the structures on his land.
Thank God for the firemen. They, the first crew I talked to had been here 35 hours straight.
Wow.
And they were waiting to be relieved. Those four trucks left, four more came in. They stayed for 2 days. Then they left. Four more came in. And like I said, the last trucks pulled out yesterday morning.
Yeah, I know these are tight-knit communities, and those who lost everything are not just dealing with this alone.
Yeah, that's one thing I heard over and over and over, which is, you know, we know what these fires are like. We've been through it before, and we have pride and respect for their self-sufficiency. There's a lot of people who stepped up donating things, supplies for horses. There was a thrift store in town that was giving supplies away for free. Everyone I talked to had a story about how they helped a neighbor if they had to evacuate large animals or their things. And everyone's saying, you know, I know so-and-so lost their house and I didn't lose my house, but we really want to come together. And I want to play one more cut from Mitch, who says, you know, we recognize that we try to do this on our own, but this one is so big, it's going to be different.
My concern is with the people up there that lost their homes. We're going to be gathering up a lot of stuff to donate in Mariposa to the families that lost their homes. What we can spare and what they need, and some cash. So there's a lot of people in Mariposa County that have nothing. So we're up to almost 70 homes completely lost, and I think another 19 that were partially burned, over 100 outbuildings, barns and sheds and stuff like that. So there's a lot of people suffering up here.
So he almost lost his home, and his next thought is, what can I do for my neighbors? How can I help them? What is it we can do? So it's been really quite the impressive experience to see the spirit of the folks who live in the Mariposa County area really bonding together over what could have been, what is a very bad experience, but what could have been significantly worse.
Now, probably a significant majority of mountain residents have some sort of livestock or other animals, large animals, horses, goats, sheep. That creates a big challenge also when it comes to a fire like this. And there's some really interesting photos that you took and some other media as well, showing these horses that are now in evacuation centers, and they have their owner's phone numbers spray painted on their side. Tell me about that. Why was that?
Yeah, I'm a former hearse person myself. I raised and showed horses growing up, and so I have a special spot in my heart for horses. These were people who thought they would have to let their animals go and hope for the best. So they spray paint the phone number and the address of the horse. And their thinking was, we're going to open the gate and hope that the horse can escape the fire. And maybe someone will call us later with our horse and they can return it. There was a ranch in Corsicle. There's a ranch in Madera that took on dozens of horses. And it's so expensive and it's so complicated to care for these animals. And if you've not been around horses, I mean, they have personalities like dogs and cats. And for the people who care for them and raise them, it's a part of their family. So I can't even imagine what it must be like to think to, you know, in the desperation of trying to save this horse's life, you might have to let them go. And then spray painting their phone number and their address on the side of the horse is just heartbreaking.
Yeah. And I understand that support for that rescue operation also came from all over the state, as far away as Lake Isabella and in the Kernville area, where last year, just a little over a year ago, residents there were dealing with a very similar fire, the Erskine fire.
I asked the ranch hand, Donnie Lindholm, about that, because I said, you know, this is expensive, and where's all this coming from? And he listed a bunch of different businesses and a bunch of different people that had contributed, but I want to highlight one that he mentioned, where they set up a fund for people who wanted, in addition to donating, they set up an account for people who wanted to donate from the community.
Claudia Box from Box Feed in North Fork, California, humongous donation of, we received 2 tons of hay from her. She set up a thing there to where people can call in via credit card or send them a check, you know, over the phone to help with purchases of the feed, as well as other products like we need, like fly spray, fly mask, medicines, probiotics, electrolytes, stuff like that. So she got that set up. She calls me every hour. She's like, Donnie, you have a $900 credit. You have a $1,000 credit. Do you want this in feed? Do you want this in something else?
And those credits, those are just people calling and saying, hey, I want to help these horses.
Want to jump ahead a little bit now as we're running out of time, but I want to also touch on the international angle with tourists to Yosemite. That was a big deal, especially on those
days in the middle of last week when smoke filled Yosemite Valley. You were also there. What was the mood like among the travelers? Because people from all over the world planned their vacations well in advance to come to Yosemite to see this majestic site, and it was a little smoky. It wasn't quite the vista they were expecting.
And I was expecting people to be pretty disappointed by that. I thought when I would get up there that if you've come, and I talked to people from France, from Norway, or hear from a gentleman from Britain, and I thought people were going to be disappointed because it really, I mean, I've been to Yosemite a number of times. A lot of people in our audience have been, and you know how beautiful it can be. And just to see the view obscured like that, I thought people would be disappointed. But I talked with Michael Upton, who's from Britain, and he really personifies what the mood of everyone I talked to was, which was, you know what, this is my only chance. I'm not going to let this get me down.
Yes, we were doing a hike up at Tuol Omne for 3-4 days with friends who are just over there. We just come down for the day. We finished the hike. We came down for the day to see the valley itself.
So what do you think?
Oh, it's amazing. It's amazing. It's fantastic. Honestly, the smoke doesn't bother me. I mean, I've never seen it before. I'll never see it again, but it's pretty amazing anyway.
So that's quite the British attitude,
the
I guess.
Indomitable British
carry
spirit.
On. Yeah. Keep calm and carry on. Before we go, Jeffrey, I know that this has, again, just been such a traumatic event and one that it's, even once the fire is out, is going to continue to affect that community for so long. I understand you have one more cut you want to play for Mitch Bowes.
Yeah, Mitch, who says, you know, we're going to need help from outside. As much as we embrace our internal spirit, this is going to have to come from outside.
We're a very independent county. What was your name again?
Jeffrey.
We're a very independent county. We're, you know, we don't want to say we're totally self-sufficient and don't need the outside. But Mariposa County is really one of the last old-time conservative counties in the state of California. And we like it up here because we usually don't get bothered too much by Sacramento or the Bay Area. But this is such a huge event. We're not going to get through this without outside assistance.
And we will continue to follow the Detweiler fire as firefighters continue to make progress on the blaze. Residents on the south side are continuing in the repopulation plans and the north end of the fire. That part of the fire remains active, although CAL FIRE crews are making progress there as well. Stay tuned to Valley Public Radio for further updates on that and other wildfires. Jeffrey Hess, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Lost in the news last week that California legislators have extended the state's cap-and-trade greenhouse gas reduction program was the passage of another bill that could have a significant impact locally. AB 617 expands the state's oversight over emissions in communities that are among the most polluted in the state, like the San Joaquin Valley. Here to tell us more about the bill is Julie Cart, who is a reporter with Cal Matters. Julie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Joe.
Assemblywoman Christina Garcia of Bell Gardens, who authored this bill, in a floor speech called this a down payment on environmental justice for people in her district and others throughout California. What exactly is she referring to there? What does that mean before we get into the nuts and bolts of the bill?
Yeah, I think it was a bit of a defensive posture for her. She's saying that, I interviewed her on this topic, and she was very candid. She said, look, this is an imperfect bill, as much legislation is. It is a start. And so it referenced that there's more work to be done. And also just what she would say is a lifetime of trying to fight this battle. So it begins. So game on for her.
So when we talk about this battle, what are we talking about here? We know we have mobile sources. Those are significant sources of pollution throughout the state. Cars, trucks, trains, buses, those sorts of things. There's also stationary sources. What does this bill direct its focus at?
Well, the bill is an attempt to marry the industries, the facilities that are covered under cap and trade, whose greenhouse gases are regulated, and to encompass what other things that come out of those smokestacks, the so-called criteria pollutants. And cap and trade actually intended to pay some attention to those other pollutants, but it got very carried away with itself establishing a cap and trade program. So this is kind of a corrective. So any facility, as you would have in the San Joaquin Valley, oil and gas facilities, refineries, production facilities, cement factories, any of the various industries that are regulated under cap and trade that operate in what are often called fence line communities, people who live near them, this bill would say, look, we're going to pay a lot of attention now to co-pollutants, not greenhouse gases, but air pollution.
So I understand this bill expands the state air board's authority over those polluters, those emission sources. In the past, that was more of a local thing, was it not?
Yeah, it's interesting. As critics would also point out, that the bill, again, as most legislation does, it evolved a little bit from an original bill that didn't make it out of the assembly to this legislation. So it kind of splits some hairs here. It expands the air board's oversight, but also gives quite a lot of discretion to local air districts. For example, requiring retrofitting of some facilities so that they can reduce their emissions. It allows the air districts to say, to determine the definition of best available technology and expand some other things there. So, yeah, the expanded oversight that comes from the state is really has a lot to do with the compilation and dissemination of data, because there's a lot of information that the state has about emissions, and now the state has been directed by this bill to make it public, to put it together in a way that is transparent so everyone can see.
So you alluded to some of the changes that happened in the legislative process as this bill was out there. One of them involves this issue of pollution credits. And you had, as I understand it, some polluters who were using the cap and trade credit system to avoid having to make other modifications of their facilities that would have reduced other sorts of pollution. Does this bill actually, the final bill, wind up making any significant change there?
Not really. In fact, Assemblywoman Garcia intended close what some people consider a loophole, which are these offsets and these credits that facilities can earn, so that they don't have to actually reduce pollution at its source. They can account for it somewhere else. She said she intended that to not be the case, but in fact, the language of this bill allows air districts to establish programs so that pollution credits can be traded, so that a facility in Fresno or Bakersfield that an air board or the state might say, we need you to reduce your air pollution emissions from this facility, can say, we are going to achieve that by trading pollution credits. So if you live next door or downwind of this facility and for some reason there's a health issue associated with that, it's not going to get better.
I understand this bill also increases the fines for polluters. Is that a significant part of the bill? I mean, I see this increase from $1,000 to $5,000. That doesn't seem like a whole lot if it's in regards to a large oil refinery or something like that.
It would be to me and you, Joe, but I think,
exactly.
And those are the maximum penalties. We're both in their nonprofit world, so $5,000 would really be a hit, but it's not. I think it's safe to say it's an insignificant change. It's been, people have been calling for these penalties to be more in line so that they have some bite to them, but I wouldn't say that a $5,000 maximum penalty is very much.
I understand the process of collecting this information, though, and disseminating information about pollution sources and the technologies that might be out there is also an important part of both the bill itself and also a push by interest groups on the environmental justice side to maybe move this one step further along their path. Do they view it that way?
They do, and of course, there's such general dissatisfaction with this bill that they would say it doesn't go far enough. I mean, there is data regarding air pollution emissions from these facilities. The problem is you really have to work hard to find it. And because the state air board is so focused on greenhouse gas emissions, sometimes the other pollutants are difficult and they're not collated. So this will do that, and it's very helpful. I mean, for your listeners, I was looking this morning at the CalEnviro screen, which is this really fascinating interactive tool that the state has that you can look at, search your city and in fact your neighborhood, and look at how it ranks in percentiles with pollutants and pollution and public health. And, you know, you've got the San Joaquin Valley is just this red blob of the highest scores for pollution burden. So when those cities, those counties try to counteract or react to these kinds of public health issues with pollution, they can use data like that and the data that will be promulgated from the new bill and kind of make their case that, look, this is really a serious problem.
Did industry groups get behind this as something that they could perhaps support that doesn't go as far as the original bill, or were they still opposed to this?
I think the safest thing to say here is that the industry groups got behind this to the extent that they could modify it. And the bill changed rather substantially over time, so that the 617 that was passed last week is somewhat less harsh to industry, gives a lot more discretion to local air boards that might themselves be a bit more friendly to industry and more willing to allow the kind of flexibility that we know California businesses want. So it's not the snarly, sharp-toothed bill that it was originally. It's watered down quite a lot, but that gets back to your first question about the down payment. This is something that undoubtedly, at least an attempt will be made to revisit.
How much should we read into it that this came along in companion with, together with, extension of cap and trade funding? Was something as politically touchy as this, was it significant that it was a package with something else essentially?
I think it was hugely significant that you can, in fact, CalMatters, shameless promotion, CalMatters this week, I'll have a story that looks at how cap and trade not only has not helped pollution in these communities, in some cases the policy has made pollution worse because it's allowing this the offsets, and so no local diminishment of emissions. So it was hugely important because it's seen as you have one smokestack, and cap and trade is regulating the greenhouse gas emissions, but who's responsible for the other emissions that are coming out of there? And so that's what Garcia's bill is trying to do. It's saying let's make these more cohesive as a state policy, so that in a way provide more clarity to the industry. That smokestack now will be seen as one entity, and you have to be responsible for both the greenhouse gas emissions and the air pollution emissions that come from there.
Again, we've been talking with Julie Cart. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter currently with CalMatters and has an excellent piece on AB 617, a new bill that expands state oversight over some stationary pollution sources. It doesn't go as far as some advocates on the environmental justice side wanted to see. We'll see where it goes in the future as it begins to be implemented throughout the San Joaquin Valley and across the state. You can find Julie's reporting on the CalMatters website, and there's a link at KVPR.org as well. Julie, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure, Joe.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition. We'll talk to Harold Pierce of the Bakersfield Californian about latest allegations involving an arrest made by the Bakersfield Police Department that has received national attention. Also, Mackenzie Mays of the Fresno Bee joins us to talk about her new series about sex ed and teen pregnancy in the Valley. That's all coming up on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. Earlier this year, the Department of Justice in Sacramento launched a patterns and practices investigation into the Bakersfield Police Department after a series of incidents and officer-involved shootings that drew national attention. New Police Chief Lyle Martin has been on the job for about as long, and now he has another issue to deal with. The encounter between his officers and 19-year-old Tatiana Hargrove left her with injuries from punches and from a police canine. There's also a twist in this case, though. It turns out Bakersfield police had the wrong person. Instead of a 5'2", 115-pound woman, the suspect they were looking for on Father's Day was a 5'10", 170-pound bald man. So how did Tatiana Hargrove get involved in this? And more about this story, we have with us Harold Pierce of the Bakersfield Californian to tell us about what's going on there. Harold, welcome.
Good morning, Joe. Thanks for having me.
So exactly how did this case get in the national spotlight like it has in the recent weeks?
You know, it really comes down to the NAACP and social media. The local Bakersfield chapter of the NAACP out here had released a video just a couple of weeks ago, kind of Tatiana Hargrove recapping the incident as she saw it that day on Father's Day. You know, she was going to the store to get her dad a gift. It was closed. She was coming back, and it was a situation where it was the wrong place at the wrong time, and cops were looking for a much larger man, and this canine officer rolled up, and he saw her and came out guns drawn, and immediately she's wondering why she's getting pulled over. You know, the video ended up getting, I think, something like 5 or 6 million views at this point. It's probably much higher than that. I haven't checked it in a while, but it's gotten a lot of attention. I think the reason why is just the outrage factor that police were searching for a very large man, and they pulled over a young, petite girl, and just was a case of mistaken identity. And the cops owned up to that in their police reports, is that this is the wrong person.
Yet Hargrove is still left with the injuries from that incident, and this is something that was documented in a video. Now, is this video actually of the incident, or is it a recounting of what happened?
It's a recounting of what happened, and, you know, if we had the actual video, if we had the dash cam video, I think it would shed a lot of light on the situation, because there's some conjecture as to actually what happened, what got her into the situation where she got the canine released on her. And at this point, Lyle Martin, the Bakersfield Police Department chief, has actually come out. He has he told the Californian that he apologized to the family for what had happened to their daughter, and that he doesn't believe that a canine should have been used in this case, that it could have been de-escalated. So even he has believed that, you know, this was probably a mistake on the department's part.
So now you have Lyle Martin is getting into this. I understand this investigation is now an internal investigation. Are there other investigations ongoing? How is this particular incident being followed up on?
Yeah, it's an internal investigation at this point on the part of the officer's conduct. So whether or not he should have released a canine, that's being investigated internally. But we also have to deal and contend with the arrest charges against Tatiana Hargrove, which she was arrested on, I think about five different charges. The biggest ones being resisting an officer. I believe it was a battery on an officer. And then she also got arrested and charged for interfering with a police dog because she grabbed its muzzle when it attacked her and tried to throw it off of her. So she has about five charges on her right now. The DA is still reviewing that case, and I've been told it's probably going to take about another week or so before the full review is completed. It's kind of a toss-up as to what's going to happen here. You know, a very similar situation happened to two other black college students just down the street from here in December. This is Grismore and Hines. And it was the same kind of treatment from the NAACP. They had released a viral video that got not anywhere near as many hits as the Tatiana Hargrove one, but still got a lot of attention in the community. You know, these were two kids who were walking from their apartment late at night to Taco Bell. They were getting a break, you know, from their final studying. And a couple of police officers pulled them over and said they were jaywalking in the street and consequently roughed them up and arrested them. For jaywalking, the DA threw that out. She said that there's they shouldn't have been. She actually took a really hard line stance and said there's no reason for those officers to have stopped them in the first place, and that was probably illegal. So it's really kind of a toss up as to what's going to happen here with Tatiana Hargrove. You know, with the chief coming out and already saying that he doesn't think the use of force is appropriate, it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with the DA on her end.
Now, has this increased the call for police body cameras on officers in Bakersfield?
Oh, it certainly has. Yeah, yeah. And not only that, not only the call for police body cameras, and I think that quite a few folks showed up at the last city council meeting to call for that, but it's also increased the calls for an independent citizens oversight committee for these types of issues. You know, when an officer is accused of use of force, like when we had Francisco Cerna or other situations like that, you know, these investigations are taken, they're done internally, and we never know the outcome because the Peace Officer Bill of Rights protects those peace officers from knowing what their disciplinary records are like. So if we have an officer who's, you know, has use of force all over their record for 15 years, and they have a history of, you know, potentially targeting minorities, we would never know about it as the public because it's all shrouded in secrecy because they have so many protections. But that's why folks are calling for this oversight committee from the citizens' part. Now, we talked to Lyle Martin about this, the police chief here, and he said he hasn't found a model yet that would work for Bakersfield, and he's just not quite convinced yet to do it. But those calls have come and become stronger since this incident has occurred.
I understand there's also calls from the NAACP and others to re-examine the city's charter and look at whether it needs to move to a strong mayor form of government, and also changes. When Lyle Martin was hired, there was a lot of criticism in the fact that the city charter specified that the new police chief had to come from the existing force of officers and had to be promoted from within, couldn't be from an outside candidate. Is that also something that is still on the table?
You know, I've heard a bit about that, but I haven't gotten too deep into that that particular part of this show.
And again, we're talking with Harold Pierce of the Bakersfield, California, and moving forward, there's one other aspect here, and that's just relations with the African-American community in Bakersfield. We've left out an important fact that Chief Lyle Martin is African-American. Has he reached out to members of that community with these two recent incidents? The first one actually took place before he actually took the job of police chief, the one that you mentioned with the two individuals last year.
Right, right, right. And I don't think it can be overstated enough that there are definite issues here and trust issues between the Black community and police here in Bakersfield. And Lyle Martin, I think that him stepping forward and calling the family of Tatiana Hargrove, I think that says an awful lot about his character. You know, he told me his vision for that police department is basically to remove the and, the, you know, police and the community or community and the police. He really wants it to be kind of homogeneous. He wants it to be all one. And, you know, I think that's a really, really good step forward. But the tension is going to remain there for a very long time. And I think when people hear him talking about these types of things, I think there's a lot of skepticism there because there's such a history with this department. And when you have the Black mark of being investigated by the DOJ, it certainly doesn't help your case, certainly not when it's for alleged civil rights violations.
We'll continue to follow it, as will Harold Pierce of the Bakersfield, California. You can read his excellent reporting in the Bakersfield, California, and at bakersfield.com. Harold, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
This is Valley Edition. California's cap-and-trade deal handed Democratic Governor Jerry Brown a huge climate change victory last week, but it might never have gotten done without a Republican. Assembly Minority Leader Chad Mays wants to bring California Republicans back to relevance in Sacramento by showing they can govern, not just be the party of no. That philosophy led to his crucial role in cap-and-trade's passage. But as Capital Public Radio's Ben Adler reports, it also placed May's leadership in jeopardy last week.
It was no surprise to see Jerry Brown and Democratic lawmakers at the governor's podium after cap and trade passed the California legislature Monday night. But then there was this guy.
Well, it is so good to be here. You know, it's fascinating. Republicans don't get to stand on the stage very much.
Assembly Minority Leader Chad Mays declared himself tired of partisan politics and proud of the seven other Republicans who voted for the deal.
Because what they decided was that they were going to put the people of California ahead of their own careers.
Mays said business and industry groups support cap-and-trade's market-based approach to reducing greenhouse gas emissions.
We lowered taxes, we reduced costs, we reduced regulations, and at the same time, we're going to protect our environment. That's a good deal.
But many Republican activists felt betrayed, especially by Mays, who represents parts of Riverside and San Bernardino counties. John Fleischman is a leading California conservative who publishes the Flash Report blog.
He was so obsessed with trying to make a difference, to be at the table, to be in the big boy chair, that he didn't step back to realize, hey, I'm about to cast my vote to take billions of dollars out of the private sector and put them in the hands of the corrupt legislature.
Chad Mays describes himself as a California Republican. Sure, he attended Jerry Falwell's Liberty University and interned for former U.S. Senator John Ashcroft, but he never endorsed President Trump. He talks about fighting poverty, and then...
Is this bromance? So, I hate to sound like the dating game, but I got to start off by saying, so how did you guys first meet? Like, how...
That's a moderator at a UC Riverside event this spring featuring Mays and Democratic Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon. Their bromance is a running joke at the state capitol. During the conversation, Rendon acknowledged the two couldn't be further apart ideologically.
That being said, I think we both are very realistic about the world, and we want to get stuff done. I think that's sort of our driving force.
Minutes later, Mays summed up his governing philosophy for a party that holds no statewide offices and represents just 26% of registered California voters.
The world is not perfect. Sometimes you got to look beyond that and be able to sit down and look to figure out ways of getting things done, even though things aren't as pure as they could be.
Even before cap and trade, in his year and a half as leader, Mays has worked with Democrats on several key deals. Assemblyman Brian Daly, who represents rural northeastern California and opposed cap and trade, praises Mays' leadership.
California is not like the rest of the country. We are different. People here believe a different way and expect a different style of leadership, and we're trying to provide that along with keeping our base.
But Mays has infuriated conservatives, and many want him to resign. Several Assembly Republicans unhappy with Mays declined interview requests for this story. One who was willing to talk is Travis Allen, who's running for governor.
I wouldn't be surprised to see a change in leadership. I think Californians demand that taxes get reduced in California, and they are going to hold any politicians accountable that are raising their taxes when they're already among the highest in the nation.
Mr. Mays, you are recognized.
Thank you. Republican caucus in the rules room.
Republican caucus in the rules room.
Republicans met behind closed doors as questions swirled over Mays' future as Assembly Minority Leader. But Mays lived to lead another day. Another month, in fact, since lawmakers then adjourned for summer recess. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Of the 10 highest teen pregnancy rates in California, 6 are in the San Joaquin Valley. That's a stat that is sobering. It's also something that kicks off a new series of reports in the Fresno Bee from Mackenzie Mays, who's looking at teen pregnancy and sex education in local schools. She joins us now on Valley Edition. Mackenzie, welcome.
Thank you.
I want to start out with the story of the young teen mom who was featured in the first of your stories that kicked off this series. She was forced out of her school and into a different education program due to her pregnancy. Tell us about her and what happened.
Yeah, so Graciela found out she was pregnant when she was 14. She was going to middle school in Central Unified District, and she just talked about how it was actually the administration, so like a school counselor, who said you should wear extra layers to cover your belly bump and, you know, you should probably not eat lunch in the cafeteria because the other girls are going to look at you and think it's okay to be pregnant. So eventually that counselor told her she should go to an adult school, which is a big change for a 14-year-old girl. So she just talked about how she felt like she was seen as propaganda. And it turns out that the ACLU sort of already knew all about that. There's an entire report about something they call push out, which is what happens to these young girls.
So this is a thing that, that goes beyond just her case.
Yeah, and I didn't know that. Usually as a reporter, you find a report like that and then look for somebody that it happened to. And for me, it was backward. I heard this really compelling story and then found out it was a trend.
So what happened with her and her education after that point?
She persisted, luckily. She ended up, she talks about doing homework in the middle of the night with her baby crying at 14, and she graduates early at 17. So she went to the adult school, and it was sort of like you go once a week and get packets of homework. And now she's a student at Fresno City College.
Was that an official district policy of Central Unified?
No. That breaks federal laws. You know, there are Title IX protections that say you cannot pressure a teenage girl to go to different schools. So, you know, their comment was that that doesn't reflect the district standards.
And that was the district's response in this case. Were there other incidents that we know of locally like that?
There are other incidences in the ACLU report, and that report just focuses on the Central Valley. So that was something that they knew to be true. And they don't, you know, go through and name these women, but they definitely had very similar stories to Graciela's.
So this stat of the 10 highest teen pregnancy rates in California, so many of them in the Valley, are we talking about counties, cities, school districts? What's the frame that we're looking at there?
Yeah, we're looking at counties. So the problem, I guess, is that people are so used to teen pregnancy, right? It's like, it's 2017. Why are you writing about teen pregnancy? It kind of seems like an old topic. But even though we have historic all-time lows nationally and statewide, the Valley is not making that same progress. And so there are questions about what's causing that. Is it poverty? Is it conservative politics and sort of a pushback on sex education? And so we're trying to look at why we're not making the same progress as everyone else.
Are we seeing a change in the trend even locally among those? I mean, if we're six out of 10, 60% of the highest, well, again, 6 out of 10 of those leading counties in the state for teen pregnancy, are we seeing it drop here, or is it even rising?
Some counties are seeing drops, yeah, but they're not as big as what we are seeing in other counties, and it's always sort of been clustered for the past few decades right around our area. You know, the top 10 has not changed much, basically.
So you hinted at some of the whys there. What have you found in your reporting along those lines?
Yeah, so, I mean, Fresno Unified, fourth largest school district in California, a couple years ago when we had cutbacks and budget problems, we laid off all of our sociology for living teachers, and they were the only teachers that were teaching sex ed. So therefore, while students were not learning about sex ed at all, and then nearby at Clovis Unified, there was a big court case where parents sued because they were sending home lessons that compared girls who had sex to, you know, a dirty shoe. You know, if you're not a virgin, you know, here's a virgin is a clean shoe. You know, some really problematic things. So this is kind of the very recent history we have. And now a law is setting to mandate that we teach that.
Are local districts in compliance with that law now at this point, or is it too soon to say?
They say they are, and they have to be, right? But it's like any other lesson, and that's part of my story, too, is some of the advocates are concerned. You know, I don't have any reports of them not complying with the law, but how do we know teachers are teaching science? You know, we don't have anyone sitting there and sort of hovering over these subjects, and it's a subject that can get personal, you know.
Now, the teen mom that you mentioned starting out this story, what was the response like to her story as you shared it with your readers?
Oh my gosh, it was so great. We were so pleasantly surprised by that because we knew it was a hot topic. But her story was so compelling, and I spent a lot of time with her, and she's so sweet and really trying to make her life and her daughter's life as good as possible. And we got so many offers to help her that she ended up she set up a GoFundMe and had never done that before. But it just kind of streamlined those requests, and she ended up raising like more than $4,000 just for her and her child. You know, now she says she can get a car. Just people pouring in to say we want to give something to her to make her life easier.
How challenging has it been to report on this story? Reporting on education is very difficult. You do a great job on it in general. We know that through your reporting on Fresno Unified and other things over the years. How difficult is this story, since it's such a hot-button issue? This is a generally conservative area. Has there been pushback?
Yeah, I mean, if you listen to some of my voicemails, you know, some of them are not positive. But then there are people who think it's time that we talk about it. And actually, the next part of my series is about the pushback, and it is giving voice to the people who don't believe in sex ed. And there are a lot of people here who think that's an issue that should stay within the home and within the family. And so we're going to try to touch on that, too. But I'm just trying to focus on telling the true stories of the young women who have really been impacted by that, you know.
Are there any other regions in the state that are dealing with a problem like this on the same scale as we have in the Valley, or is this truly an outlier?
Yeah, no, this is it. We're it. You know, we keep hearing these reports every year about nationwide how great the teen pregnancy rates are declining. And statewide, you know, California is praised across the country for how progressive we are with our sex ed and the increases we've made and sort of doing better, but we're sort of this big red blip in the in the map of all that progress.
The California Department of Public Health has also called out this area for a very high incidence of a number of sexually transmitted diseases. Do the health professionals you've talked to and the educators you've talked to, do they see those two as being linked?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that's part of sex ed. And I have heard that if actual sex hasn't been taught in schools, that at least you're teaching STDs usually. But what I'm hearing from advocacy groups is that it's the scare tactics that a lot of teachers in the past would just show these, you know, stage 10 STD photographs to kids to really scare them, but didn't really teach you what leads up to that, right? So don't do this. And, you know, here are the early signs. So I think we, for sure, we're hoping that the sex ed law will also help take care of those STD rates.
When's your next piece coming out?
That's a great question.
Soon.
No, yeah, maybe this weekend. I'm working on it. We've done three pieces, and we're just going to keep writing them until there's nothing more to write.
Mackenzie Mays of the Fresno Bee has a new multi-part series that is out now and is rolling out online at FresnoBee.com and in the paper about teen pregnancy and sex education in local schools. Mackenzie, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, or send us a tweet. We are @KVPR and @Valley Edition. You can also find our podcasts, including Outdoorsy, Valley Public Radio News Podcast, and this Valley Edition podcast, on our website at kvpr.org, and audio archives there as well. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Carrie Klein and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, celebrating 20 years dedicated to advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. chcf.org.